Welcome to the All In for Citrus podcast, the latest on citrus research from the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences statewide citrus team in partnership with Southeast AgNet Radio Network.
Welcome to the All In for Citrus podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Michael Rogers, the director of the Citrus Research and Education Center in Lake Alfred. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, we're in that time of year. We're in early March. I was driving through some citrus groves today, and they are full of blooms, and I rolled the windows down to enjoy the smell. But I understand today you want to talk a little bit about another important milestone this time of year, irrigation, and making sure these trees are not wanting for water. So we can just dive right into that and talk about some of your thoughts and observations about what growers need to be thinking about this time of year.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. And absolutely, you know, we've got bloom going on, and this is a key time to be thinking about irrigation and how it affects next year's yields. We've come out of a winter. It's been relatively wet. You know, it's not evenly distributed rain throughout the season, but if you look at the ag weather data, I was just looking at that a few minutes ago. For the central and south part of the state, we're anywhere from a little above normal to as much as 4 inches above normal rainfall. So we've had a good winter in terms of rainfall compared to past years. So that's a bit of good news. It's helped our trees continue to recover a little bit and deal with some of the issues post hurricanes and things like that. But right now we're approaching what typically is the driest time of the year. We're seeing the temperatures start to increase a little bit. And so all this comes together right at a time where we've got bloom. We've got bloom happening. And this is really the key time for irrigation, not letting our trees experience water deficit, because how you irrigate to reduce water deficit at this time of year is absolutely the key factor in fruit retention and yields for the coming season. And I've heard our horticulturalist in life has talked about this in the past, like expo presentations in years past. And it kind of surprised me. I always thought when you had larger fruit on the trees, it was more important to have a lot of irrigation then. I'm not saying it's not important then, but really it's what happens at this time of the year, you know, from bloom till you get those small fruitlets, you're really determining the fate of the fruit right now with how you irrigate these trees. And this is way more important now than it was pre-HLB. And the reason is, you know, our HLB disease trees that we're growing now, they're way more likely to experience drought stress or water deficit, really because of all the root loss that these trees have experienced. And you add in the really sandy soils that we have. And so the root system is prone to dry down much more quickly. And we're talking hours, not days. And so when you're trying to grow, set a crop, keeping the root system out of water deficit is extremely critical at this time of the year. And so, you know, running your irrigation system for longer periods of time isn't the answer, because the roots, you'll still dry out that root system at the same speed, but running it longer, you're just going to move those nutrients out of the root zone as well. You risk doing that. So really, the answer to this that our folks have been talking about for some time, we've heard them talk about it, is more frequent but smaller volumes of irrigation. It's spoon feeding water like we've talked about doing with nutrients. And again, our researchers like Dr. Katia McKinney, Dr. Vashish, have talked a lot about this over the years. But more recently, Dr. Vashish just completed a second year of a study, an irrigation study with one of her students that really highlights the importance of this more frequent small doses of irrigation and the real tremendous benefits it can have on fruit yield. And if you haven't seen a write-up that just came out, it was the March 5th tip of the week that's on the Citrus Industry Online. I encourage folks to have a look at that. And really what that column by Dr. Vashish and her student Mary Sutton, they were looking at two different irrigation regimes where they had either kind of a grower's, this is on Valencia orange, by the way. And so in Valencia is pretty prone to this because you have at this time of year, you have a bloom and the existing crop probably still on the trees. So a lot of stress on those trees, and you got to make sure you're irrigating them right. So they had two irrigation treatments. One was every other day. They were irrigating for 2 hours. That was what they were calling the grower standard. And then they had another set of blocks where they were irrigating every day as much as 2 to 3 times a day for 20 minutes. And the idea there was they were trying to show if they didn't let the trees go into water deficit at this time of the year, what effect would it have on in terms of yield? And so they weren't receiving the trees in this everyday irrigation treatment, they weren't receiving more water overall. It was the same amount as the other treatment. It was just smaller doses over time. And again, just not letting those trees dry down and experience that water deficit. And so what they found in this study was that where they were doing the more frequent irrigation this time of year, they had better bloom, consistent bloom, a lot more flower buds on the trees. They had a lot better fruitlet retention. And also, you know, the canopies also had much higher leaf production. And another thing they also saw, kind of an observation that was pretty interesting, I think a lot of folks remember back in May of 2023, we had a lot of groves saw a second wave of bloom late in May. And it was because of the drought we had experienced that stressed the trees and induced another bloom. But where they had those treatments, where they were doing the everyday irrigation, they didn't see that second wave of flowers in May. Whereas the controls, where they're only getting watered every other day, they did have that second wave of bloom. But overall, what happened is they ended up doubling the yields by just adjusting the irrigation to this everyday regime versus every other day. And so I'm not suggesting that everyone can instantly double your yields by changing, you know, irrigation practices, but there is a potential, you know, depending on how much water deficit your trees are experiencing at this time of the year, for making some significant improvements in fruit retention and yields for the coming season. But really, the most important thing here, though, is just to understand the importance of irrigation at this time of the year and think about what you can do practically to reduce water deficit. I've been in a lot of large growing operations where they're not set up to irrigate two or three times a day, every day. They have to drive out, manually turn on irrigation zones. And by the time they get around to all the zones, you know, it's several hours and they have to go back around and turn them off. You know, that's one of those situations where you have to think about, okay, what can we realistically do to try to reduce water deficit? And while changing irrigation patterns to me sounds like a pretty simple concept, it's really going to be a manpower logistics issue that has to be worked out on an operation by operation basis. And this is something that we're even doing at the CREC right now with all of our research groves. We've seen that irrigation has really become a problem for us with HLB and many of our older blocks. Unfortunately, we've got some of our older blocks. We still have old, those large below ground main lines that were set up to run overhead irrigation, really high volumes of water. We never replaced those. Before HLB, it wasn't an issue. We converted those over to microjets and it was okay. But it takes 25 minutes to pressurize those lines. And so when that's happening, we're dumping a ton of water on one end of the grove while the other's not getting watered. And by the time the other starts getting watered, we're not providing the right distribution and timing of irrigation for all of our trees. So we're in the planning process right now of replanting some of our blocks. One of the first things that we're doing is trying to increase or get better control and distribution of water. We think that's really key. And again, that for us, that means in part replacing some of these below ground outdated lines that we've got. And so we're doing some of that. And for our more remote groves, as money allows, we're trying to invest in controllers so we can program water schedules to do more frequent irrigation. We don't have the manpower to run out and turn on and off valves all of the time, but we're trying to do more remote operations where we can. It's not always possible depending on the motors we have and the systems, but where it's possible, we're trying to convert over to those automated controllers to provide that more frequent irrigation. So those are just some examples of some of the things that we're doing right now as we work to address HLB in our groves. And again, recognize that, you know, fine tuning of irrigation, especially during the dry season, is really critical for us in helping to improve the health of our HLB disease trees. And I just also mentioned that for those of you who are interested in hearing more about Dr. Vashish's latest results on that irrigation study, she is going to be presenting that work at the upcoming 2024 Florida Citrus Growers Institute in Avon Park, and that's on April the 9th. And so we look forward to seeing everybody there and hear the latest on that work. And again, you can go online to the Citrus Industry, the Tip of the Week website, and find that and other tips of the week. We try to put stuff out that's timely and relevant. And I think that's one that really is timely for us this time of year.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we talk so much about the fertilizer and the nutrition into things, which is critically important. But if I'm hearing you, this irrigation is right there with it, you know, if not on par, a close second.
Absolutely. I mean, they're both important. You know, the water really does a lot to keep the trees from experiencing deficit and dropping fruit. I remember back before we ever recognized the whole tie-in with the root system of citrus trees, and, you know, the root loss, what was happening from HOB, and going out in this, you know, it was about this time of year, probably it was probably May, and seeing early in the morning, the trees look nice. By midday, the leaves are rolled up like a cigar almost, because they're experiencing that water deficit. And then, you know, the next morning they'd be fully expanded again. But after several cycles, we started seeing lots of fruit drop. And it was just because we weren't able to irrigate enough, or we weren't irrigating properly. We were relying a lot on rainfall, but you can't at this time of year. You really have to keep that root zone wet and keep those trees happy. And again, it all comes down to just managing the health of trees. It's, you know, irrigation's important, nutrition's important, and that we keep on preaching. That's the base of our program. That really is a non-negotiable. It's what you got to do for these groves right now. And then we can talk about adding on all these other treatments and things to try to improve things even further.
Absolutely. Kind of the foundation that you start there and then go from there with those key elements. So that's great, Michael. Anything else you want to chat about today?
No, we've got, as I mentioned, you know, Growers Institute coming up on April 9th. And then a few days before that, the Florida Citrus Show in Fort Pierce. So we look forward to seeing folks at both of those events. And there'll be more things coming out as well, meetings around the state. So we just look forward to seeing folks out and wish everybody a good start to the spring.
Absolutely. Ed, we'll look forward to seeing everyone in these upcoming events, and I'll catch up with you again next month.
All right. Thanks a lot, Frank.
Up next, we have Lauren Diepenbrock, an entomologist with the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. And we're going to talk bugs today and citrus bugs. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you.
One pest that we haven't heard a lot about in citrus is chili thrips, and that's a pest that seems to be raising its head in a lot of other crops too, and now you're seeing some evidence of it in a certain type of citrus. So let's start the conversation there. Just tell us a little bit about what you're observing and where you're observing chili thrips.
Sure. So first off, I'm going to say chili thrips, if you haven't seen them, they're a lot smaller than flower thrips, which we're very much accustomed to in citrus. And they've been a problem for years in Florida, especially in a lot of the ornamental crops and our berry crops. And more recently, we're seeing them moving into the nurseries and into the citrus under protected screens or cups systems. And they are causing quite a bit of damage to the fresh foliage as well as developing fruits in the cups houses.
Any idea of why they're there? I know this is kind of an emerging thing, so everybody's still learning about what's going on and the whys and what's with it.
Yeah, I don't know why. They seem to be moving seasonally. We have some really nice population data. We just wrapped up a two-year study looking at their seasonal presence and abundance in cups houses. And we do see an influx around this time of year as we're seeing flush and flowering happening on the trees. Very possible that they're just attracted to that heavy amount of flush and flower. But again, we can't say that definitively. And they're just in the habitat. So if they find a great resource, why not?
Right. And then, of course, obviously that screen is not big enough to exclude them because they're so tiny.
Unfortunately, no. It's very good at keeping psyllids out, very good at keeping leaf miner out unless it gets ripped. But it cannot keep things like thrips and mealybugs out, unfortunately.
Have you any kind of, I'm sure you're probably working on some control recommendations. Just tell us a little bit about where you're at with that and just, you know, what growers should do that have those kind of systems.
Yeah. So the first steps we were trying to figure out is when is it a problem? Because you don't want to tell a grower, hey, you have to spray constantly for this pest because you see damage. We want to know when they're actually active. And so now we're actually at a point where we can say, hey, we know when they're coming into your houses and we know when they started to stay out throughout the entire cups system. And so we haven't done as much on the pesticidal side of life, mostly because a lot's been done already. So like I mentioned earlier in our conversation, you can look at some really nice work that's been done by our colleagues, Sharanka Lahiri, Oscar Liebert, and others in the region. And you can see where a lot of the chemistries are or not working. We do know that certain classes or a certain class, the neonicotinoids are pretty much ineffective at controlling this pest. So it's not really worth the money to use that product for this particular pest.
Right. And those two researchers, those were blueberries and strawberries, correct?
Yes. And I'm sure I'm missing others. There's so much information out there.
Very good. So it's just something that you guys will be tracking and working on some recommendations over the next year or so.
Oh, yeah. We have quite a bit more work planned.
Great. Well, speaking of, you've done quite a bit of work on the Olivic mealybug. And I know that's been a focus for you and a problem in cups and outside as well. So talk a little bit about, you know, where that pest is in terms of pressure and what are some of the things that you've learned in your work?
So one thing, it's interesting you mentioned the outdoor and the cup scenarios. They're very different when it comes to Leduc mealybug. So we have a pretty good handle on Leduc mealybug activity outside in the groves. We know about when they start really getting active, getting abundant. You could probably start seeing some crawlers right about now if you're really looking and trapping for them. And you'll probably see it, some adults coming on probably around the time you start seeing a heavier flush and additional bud swell. We usually see it when fruit are setting, and they can do quite a bit of damage outdoors. What we don't talk about as much as is the damage that happens inside of cups. Once they're in there, and they do very well in there. It's a hot, humid, awesome environment for growth for plants. But unfortunately, it's also an awesome environment for growth of Leduc mealybug. And it does incredibly well in this habitat. And it is something that we really cannot spray away in that habitat. It's probably going to be something that's going to require longer term management that will incorporate something that can eat it, some kind of a predator and insecticide, very well timed. So one of my colleagues has been working on developing a lure to help determine when they're active so we can target those active life stages. I think we've talked about this in previous podcasts where you have the juveniles, they're a lot easier to kill. You can smother them with oil and you don't really have to use anything that harsh versus the adults with the wax all over them. They can be pretty challenging to manage at that point. And so we're still exploring a lot of systemic chemistries and trying to figure out what rates we need from the systemic side to kill them if we're going to do a drench or a translaminar. A lot of the topicals really just don't work for the adults. So if we can target those mobile juvenile stages, both outdoors and indoors, we have a lot better chance of getting the population under control before we see a lot of damage. And in the cups houses, we are already seeing reproductive populations pop up for the season. So if cups growers are not currently managing, they probably need to be.
Is it pretty universal? Are they showing up in most of the cup structures? Or yeah. Is it more general location?
I think they just do really well in cups. So one thing that we learned from a previous student is that the crawlers are very easily dispersed on the wind. It does not take much wind to move those crawlers. I can't give you the numbers offhand because they're somewhere in a file and not in front of me. But it does not take much wind to move those crawlers off of a tree somewhere else. So think about when we get these storms. Even the other day, we had some really heavy winds, and that would be sufficient to move those crawlers around. All of a sudden, you blow them through the mesh, which we already said is not small enough to exclude them. They get on some trees. Nothing's there to eat it. If they don't encounter a pesticide with a good residue, they're going to proliferate and they don't need to mate. So one crawler that survives to adulthood could then mean 1,000 eggs, potentially another 1,000 crawlers coming out in a few weeks, and it just keeps growing from there. So it is a really big challenge, especially for the cup scorers, and some of them have got a pretty good handle on it. It's still something that we don't 100% have figured out, but we're making pretty good strides in getting better management protocols for.
Or outside, you mentioned the crawlers are beginning to move now. Just generally talk about the, you know, scouting time frame and application time frame for the outside groves.
Yeah, so one of the things that we found, I think about 2 years ago, we started suggesting that late in bloom to put out a bee-friendly systemic chemistry like Movento or Senstar. We've seen really good efficacy of Movento in our field trials as far as keeping your fruit healthy. With the early season, that's kind of the big concern is we know that Leduc mealybug can impact fruit set and cause heavy fruit drop on top of the fruit drop that we already are going to see in the system. So we want to reduce the impact of this mealybug by incorporating a chemistry that is labeled to be bee-friendly because you have bloom out, but also that we know has that systemic chemistry that can reduce the population buildup. We don't have all the rates worked out, but most people putting out at the rates available for psyllid pressure are having pretty good control of the Leduc mealybug and able to have a nice fruit set without too much damage on it.
So that psyllid rate seems to work and probably is picking up any of those that might be out there at the time.
And they're out there. They've been part of the season, very low density, but they're out there.
Right. And then the snails, you've been sort of on the forefront of the snail work too. And I know those can be a real annoyance for growers. Talk a little bit about how that problem has spread and what you've learned about it.
Yep. This is a steep learning curve to work with snails. It's not something you learn in entomology because they're not insects, but the snails have been really an interesting organism to work with. We're first told about them by growers in 2020. They didn't really seem that bad, but each year the area seems to expand where they're at and the pressure gets higher and higher, suggesting that we have few to no real predators that can keep their populations down. And we do know things like birds and reptiles can eat the snails. There's probably other things. I mean, I'm sure small rodents are eating them. But the reality is they're not keeping up with the population pressure. And as of right now, most of our chemistries that are currently labeled for use on snails, which is mostly going to be your baits, are not really sufficient. They work to a point. It all depends on the snail's ability to encounter the bait. And in many cases, that's going to rely on you being able to attract them away from wherever they are, which is generally your microjets. And I just got a report last week of them being up in some of the IPCs in a young planting and causing foliar damage. So getting them out of the IPCs is pretty important for supporting your tree health. So that's something that we need to start doing a little bit of work on to figure out what can I use as far as what's in my insecticidal regime. That I'm using maybe for scales or mealybugs that might also have some efficacy as far as just getting them off the plant. Because it's not really feasible for a grower to go out there and hand pluck all these snails. Now, my lab's doing this tomorrow. They're actually going and grabbing a bunch of the snails because I need to try to kill snails and I don't have enough pressure locally. So they're driving south to get me some snails to work on. But yeah, they're just starting to really get active for the season. So growers who haven't thought of a management program for them yet need to start thinking about what can I do and what tools do I have available to me. Those again are mostly going to be the baits or what's labeled. We are working with other products that are in use for other pests in the system to see if we can get some extra bang for our buck. And I'll show some of those data at Citrus Institute in April.
Very good. And as you mentioned, it was in pockets. Any particular parts of the state where they seem to be worse or near water or away from water or, any kind of localized thing that makes them seem to be worse?
So that's actually something we've been debating. In areas where I'm seeing more like vegetative ground cover, so grasses, cover crops and whatnot, they don't actually seem to be on the irrigation jets as much as, say, largely sandy areas. And so that there might be a habitat preference for these snails. They are in a group of what's known as tree climbing snails. And so it's possible that when the ground gets too warm, which the sand's going to get a lot hotter than vegetation, that they start climbing up structures, whether that be a microjet, a tree, a house, a tractor, my leg, that has happened. They just climb up to get off of the surfaces. And it's most likely due to temperature and dryness. And then one thing we actually learned this year is that when it gets cold, they burrow down in the sand. So they're not dead in the winter. They're there. And actually on warmer days in my apartment complex, I will actually see them out on the sidewalk. Like when it's cold all day long, but it's kind of warm in these more urbanized areas, they are active. And so they seem to be very temperature and moisture dependent as far as their activity. And that is something that we could probably take advantage of as far as timing management. So we are doing some population work right now to figure out when they start getting active. And we've just started seeing them coming out in just a couple of our groves right now. And so going forward, that means that we'll probably be timing management to mid-March to think about when to start managing these pests.
Okay. And from a scouting standpoint, it's probably either they're there, they're pretty easy to spot if they're out there, right?
When they're bigger. So when they're small, they're actually kind of challenging. They're incredibly small. When they're first hatched out, they don't have a shell. So they kind of look, they're more like a slug when they first hatch out of their egg. And then as they eat, they'll consume things that have a lot of calcium in them, and then they secrete their shell around them. And then as they start secreting that shell, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. But even the very, very small ones, they're incredibly like tip of a ball pen small. So they're very easy to miss in those smaller stages. But the best part for us is that they tend to have a mixed population. So they're not all really small and they're not all really big all at the same time. So you're more likely to actually see them because you see some of the larger, more mature snails. And I'm saying this loosely because we don't actually know if size equals age or maturation at this point. Snails are weird. Snails do their own thing. We're slowly teasing apart some biological information, but they're a very different beast than what we're accustomed to. And so we're kind of relearning how to do things.
Right. And I think you're collaborating with the University of Georgia some on this pest.
So I have several collaborators here in Florida. I'm actually working with Nicole Quinn over at Indian River. She's a biocontrol expert, and she's actually found, this is really gross, but really cool, these mites that are embedded into the lungs of the snails. And so we don't know if that's going to be something that we could use towards biological control of this pest, but maybe that might, there are mites in the snail industry that are actually problematic and that they manage. And they brought their own predator with them. And how can we promote that predator? So this is some work that's kind of in the beginning stages, but it has some potential. And then more broadly, we actually have a working group throughout the whole Southeast region because the snail has spread throughout much of the Southeast. And so we're talking regularly with colleagues throughout the region. We talk with our Georgia counterparts quite a bit. But it's even like up into Kentucky and Alabama. So we have a whole Southeast region is pretty much potentially impacted by it.
Yep. And that's all crops, right?
Yep. It has no preference that we know of. It likes something everywhere. Ground cover crops are big. It loves anything that has ground cover vegetation. Most snails are detritivores. So they want to be in that dead, decaying vegetation or anywhere where there's like algae or anything delicious like that. And so, yeah, they'll cause damage on all sorts of different crops and in different ways, because we don't usually see direct damage in citrus unless there's already damage to a tree, but they cause indirect damage by clogging our microjets, thereby preventing water from getting to the trees that need them, versus something like, we know that they'll feed directly on squash. That's really not good for our vegetable growers. That's really problematic. So it has a whole host of things that it can do.
Right. Well, good deal. Well, Lauren, it's always fun to have you on to talk about bugs and snails.
I'm always down for talking about bugs.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks again for joining us, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
All right. Thanks, Frank.
Thanks for listening to this month's All In for Citrus podcast from the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences statewide citrus team in partnership with Southeast AgNet Radio Network.